In this episode, Jawhid and I connected with Gregory Landau, the CEO and co-founder of Regen Network. Regen Network is building an ecological data and asset marketplace on top of a technological knowledge commons. Specifically, today, Regen is originating digital carbon assets in order to stimulate Web3-enabled regenerative finance. This is a great primer episode for folks who want to understand the theory and practice behind regenerative finance. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Hey, Gregory. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, awesome to be here, Jawhid. Hey, Martin. Good to see you both.
So we usually like to start these things with just a quick little intro. So perhaps you could tell us the story of Gregory. How'd you get here? And start wherever you like.
Okay. The story of Gregory. Well, you know, the Cliff Note version, I guess, is I was born in Alaska. I am the son of a wildlife biologist and a chemical engineer. So my parents were working on sort of like, I guess you could say, different sides of the, I guess maybe sort of like the do less harm economy and the extractive economy. And out of that, in some way, you know, that experience growing up and having great parents, but that were sort of like on different sides of things in a way, I think kind of was helped me live in this tension in which from a very early age, I was always fascinated, maybe to the point of obsession, with how things could be different. You know, and one of the formative questions that I had growing up, so I worked on all the different sides of the fishery in Alaska, the salmon fishery, which is broadly considered to be one of the healthiest, most well-managed natural resource stories in the world. Now, just because it's one of the best managed resources in the world doesn't mean it's well-managed. It's just, it's all relative, you know, compared to lots of disasters. Yeah. And the thing that fascinated me growing up was the way that the community decided in the end to manage a scarce resource was to make it very expensive to harvest by forcing people to go chase the salmon around the ocean in boats. So, you know, the essential way of managing that, right, ended up being, hey, you need to buy a license and there's a market for the license. And once you get the license, you need to have a boat and you need to pay for diesel fuel and you need to go sort of like gamble on the open ocean that you're going to encounter the fish during these discrete windows of time. When everyone knows that the fish are all coming to the same rivers every year, and that as a society, we could be enormously lazy, right? We could be enormously lazy and all the fish would just come to us. But instead, we're going to sort of like play out this rugged individualist fantasy, going out and chasing the fish down and bringing them home. And it just fascinated me. I was like, what is it about our culture and this situation that instead of kind of like working through resource allocation questions and then just every year having a big fucking party on the beach when the fish came in and enjoying that and allocating the resources in some way that was decided and, you know, adhered to, instead, yeah, we were like, no, we're going to go chase these around and it's going to cost us lots of money and we're going to burn lots of diesel fuel. And, you know, that was a living question for me. And I participated in that fishery. I was a commercial fisherman. I worked for the Watershed Forum. I worked for Fish and Game. My first job ever was on the slime line working in a cannery, like the most menial of the jobs in the whole ecosystem.
What is the slime line?
The slime line is where the fish that have been caught are coming in through a factory and they're getting their heads chopped off, their guts ripped out, and then they're either getting filleted or flash frozen or canned. And it's working in a factory, right?
That's exactly what I thought it was, but I wanted to make sure Because
yeah, so you know, I was there.
This is our jargon. This is the non-Web3 jargon for this episode.
Exactly. So that was my first job. You know, when I was 14, I was working like 18-hour days in the slime line in Alaska.
Wow.
And anyway, and thinking about this stuff, like, why are we doing it this way? Like, why are we doing it this way? So that's, you know, and maybe just a quick fast forward. I went out of state to Oregon to study environmental science. I had a, you know, sort of a study abroad gap year in there. And I basically leapt straight into permaculture, regenerative agriculture, kind of eco-village and intentional community world right out of college as what seemed to me the most promising set of solutions where people were willing to experiment holistically across the full spectrum of social technologies, sort of appropriate technologies, land use, and be thinking, how are we going to recombine things in a very practical, grounded way to meet human needs while increasing ecological health and sort of move forward from there. And, you know, really the rest is, I guess, maybe a little bit more in the public record, because then I start being, you know, my vocation then becomes quite a public affair, I guess.
Right. So take us through to that, because I think, you know, I don't think everyone, maybe you've talked about it for one other podcast, but, you know, you did the permaculture thing. You started a cooperative, I believe, in Ecuador, or maybe it was chocolate or coffee. I don't remember exactly. But yeah, give us a bit of detail, because I think it all feeds into Region Network itself eventually.
It does, definitely. Yeah. Well, so I kind of started apprenticing myself and in the permaculture world. And my entry into that was actually to become a sort of an education coordinator. So, but the education was permaculture, appropriate technology, consensus, sort of like social consensus, sociocracy, these sorts of things in permaculture education centers. So I sort of apprenticed myself and was going back and forth between doing sort of the applied stuff and doing the education as a kind of course helper, and then increasing responsibilities over the course of a few years. And eventually I actually took over as the director of the Ecovillage Training Center at the farm in Tennessee, which is one of the oldest running kind of permaculture and appropriate technology nodes in North America. It also happens to be on a venerable hippie commune with its own kind of crazy story about starting out fully communal, right? Where they were all living on less than a dollar a day, and they had a fully communal, like when you showed up, you gave all your belongings to the group, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And it was a total mess, right? And they went through this whole learning experience. They crashed and burned. They had lots of crazy shit happen. And then they evolved to basically like a land trust, homeowners association, sort of like, you know, liberal bubble in Middle Tennessee, kind of, where people owned their own business and effectively owned their own house and managed their own affairs, but then had a sort of, you know, like a, essentially sort of like a little homeowners association, sort of city council managing the land and, you know, creating bylaws for blah, 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 blah. So they had gone through this whole journey. I was embedded in that community running essentially a small business, which was the Ecovillage Training Center, which did several permaculture design courses a year, some Ecovillage design education courses, you know, solar photovoltaic stuff, appropriate technology, mushroom, small business mushroom inoculation stuff, natural building stuff. And in the midst of all of that, I was like, and we were running that as a co-op. Right. So I was the in quotes director. But when I had taken the job, I was like, I'm not going to do this alone. I'm not actually just don't just hire me as the director. You're going to hire a co-op of us and we'll have different roles. Right. But we had a contract with essentially a little like limited liability partnership in which everybody had equal votes. And there was four of us that went together and basically took over running the center together as a co-op.
Nice.
So that co-op, as a co-op, nested in this bigger intentional community, running this education center, we started thinking about a couple dimensions, but one of the things was we really didn't have anything besides education as an income stream, or and there's big challenges with that. And so that's when chocolate emerges and cacao emerges.
Got it.
And we, and there's like a whole crazy side story there, which is endlessly fascinating, about me kind of getting conned into taking over this hillbilly hippie chocolate business. He's a fascinating character. He'd worked with the Sandinistas for, you know, like many years. Yeah. And yeah, just like really crazy. So I took over operating his small business, which was sourcing cacao from a women's co-op in Nicaragua. I had a existing, very rooted relationship with a small community in Ecuador, which is also its own crazy story. And we started doing sort of a direct trade kind of CSA model, subscription chocolate business, basically to augment what was going on in the education center and try to build a little bit of sort of like micro industry, food, cacao, chocolate stuff. And all of this was within this sort of like beautiful, idyllic vision that I had of building a sale trade network, and actually like getting to the point where we were moving the products with sailboats and doing a completely alternative Wild. Sort of like circulatory flow of the goods and services.
Yeah.
And needless to say, that piece has yet to actualize, although I'm still somewhat fixated on it.
Nice. I mean, yeah, absolutely. So am I. Because, I mean, you enter like sailboats, micro production, micro distribution. This is super interesting. Bioregionalism potentially enters into play. There's a lot of interesting shit happening there. But
so much. It was so rich. And, you know, we hosted the last to date bioregional congress there at the farm. Yeah. So we were trying to support the bioregional movement and thinking about that. So much emerged out of that. So out of that moment in times, like 3 years on the farm in Tennessee, I co-founded Terragenesis International, which then later incubated Regen Network. I founded what we were calling Booyah Cacao, which then turned into Nova Monda Cacao and Chocolate, and, you know, anchored a lot of different experimentation. And we sort of brought the seeds in a lot of ways of the regenerative agriculture movement together, because by the end we were running these events with all of the leading sort of like experimenters in at the edge of what has now sort of become regenerative agriculture, at least within sort of like one of the wings or lineages of it. And then the last piece that happened, maybe most that's most directly related to Regen Network in a way, is we started hosting this participatory workshop summit thing that we were calling the Financial Permaculture Course. And so the first one was in 2008 during the middle of the financial collapse. I think it was in 2008. We did another one in 2009. There were subsequent ones after. And that Financial Permaculture Course was pretty crazy. We were bringing together senators from Tennessee, small business owners, solar experts, waste experts, agriculture experts, finance experts. We were doing complementary currency design in this small rural place in Tennessee. We were talking about, people were envisioning what you might call it different things, but what sort of a solidarity or economy based on mutualism and regeneration, local production would look like and how to get there. And I think we planted a lot of seeds. Some of the seeds that were planted and emerged at that time, Ethan and I coalesced what we were observing in that kind of participatory design workshop space into the eight forms of capital. A lot of what we were talking about.
Let's pause here, actually, before you get, so the eight forms of capital is exactly kind of what I wanted to back into. What, before we get into that, one thing I wanted to ask you was, we unpack some jargon here for folks. Can you tell us real quick, what is permaculture? Because I think a lot of people are like, what is that?
Permaculture is a, what's it called when you smash two words together? Portmanteau of permanent and agriculture. It is a, described often as a design science. that is focused on the question of how to meet human needs while increasing ecological health is the definition that I like the most. I'm stealing that from a great permaculture teacher called Rafter Sass Ferguson. That's my favorite definition. Permaculture is as a design science, is built around three main ethics. So it has an ethical frame as a design science, which is often unique. Those three ethics are earth care, people care, and fair share or future care is sometimes talked about. And so fair share, people have some different takes on it, but it's also sort of like equitable redistribution of resources is one of the ethics in sort of from the beginning. And then it has a set of principles that were based on observing indigenous traditional ecological knowledge and land use practices, science, and a bundle of just like natural observation. So it has a set of design principles. There's actually probably five or six discrete sets of design principles depending on what school of permaculture you're coming from. It was founded by two Australian gentlemen with very different approaches. So there was Bill Mollison, who is sort of the apocryphal, heretical, sort of iconoclast, sort of like macho storytelling, charismatic leader type. And then there's David Holmgren, and Bill Mollison has since passed away. And then David Holmgren, who is more of the quiet, sort of studious, empirical, understated archetype. And so within that, then there's permaculture. I think I was part of sort of the fifth wave of permaculture. I think since then, there's at least two more waves that have happened. So it's quite a crazy, weird movement, permaculture.
So I think there's a lot of really interesting principles there that you touched on within permaculture. You know, I like this earth care, people care, fair share, or future care. I think the last two you said were kind of were somewhat interchanged, depending on who you ask. So I think like in order for you to even be able to share, you have to be like, how much did we share? How do we share how much we make? There's a lot of questions around, you've been saying the term resource allocation, stuff like that, right? And I think that feeds right into what you're about to tell us about eight forms of capital, right? Because that's what I found really interesting about your past work and a lot of the stuff that, you know, you sent me before we, you know, when we first met, you're like, check out this book. I'd love to dig into that just because this is now becoming a key area and it touches on your background a lot, right? Like when you think about capital these days, people think of there's land, there's financial capital, there's a bunch of at least two there, that two or three that people commonly think of as capital inputs. And depending on who you ask and how financially savvy you are, but you wrote a book called Eight Forms of Capital, and it seems like much of it must have come out of your experience in working with systems that are trying to lead to better ecological health outcomes and such like that. So I'd love to hear a bit more about how did you back into this Eight Forms of Capital thesis after, you know, around that time when you were digging into permaculture?
Yeah. So the book is called Regenerative Enterprise, version one. And the subtitle is Optimizing for Multi-Capital Abundance. And then it's sort of framed around the eight forms of capital, which we would consider a framework to guide questions and inquiry around types of wealth. And we used it a lot in conjunction with holistic management, holistic goal setting, which is its own discipline that is commonly practiced in the permaculture world and the holistic management world. Alan Savory created holistic management. The eight forms of capital is widely taught now in permaculture design courses. And a lot of people are sort of teaching, I guess, sort of the enterprise business planning sections of permaculture courses sort of from or inspired by regenerative enterprise. So it's kind of become a little bit of a cult classic within the permaculture community. A disclaimer, I think in a lot of ways it's outdated. We're due for a version update, I think, someday when I have the time and or a group of people would like to collaborate on that. I think that'd be great. And as you mentioned, the eight forms of capital really did emerge through observation, right? So it wasn't an abstract academic process where we started to uncover the eight forms of capital. We were observing the patterns of sort of like common types of value that could be grown and stored and leveraged and exchanged between themselves within a business or between businesses, within a community or between communities. We really wanted to create a framework to broaden, to do two things, to broaden people's understanding who are fixated with financial capital, right? To use language that allowed them to see other forms of value and start into an inquiry around how to make those other forms of value visible, how to think about and design interactions with them consciously. Legible is another way of thinking, you know, we're sort of like the legibility between different forms of capital. But we also created the framework so that people who were rejecting money and business and finance as sort of like in a polarized way as like the root of all evil, we wanted to invite them to consider that there are many forms of value, and financial value, financial capital is sort of like
just one,
is just one. And in fact, just like anything else, could be well designed and well managed or poorly designed and poorly managed. And so that it isn't sort of just like, in quotes, sort of like a cancer that if it was gone, we'd be fine.
Right.
But instead, no, this, like, yes, things are imbalanced. And so we can use the eight forms of capital to say things like the dominant flows over the last, I don't know, 300 years or so have been the liquidation of living capital for the accumulation of financial capital. We can say, we can point the same thing. We can say cultural capital. We can say cultural capital is currently being liquidated and metabolized and turned into financial capital. We can talk about the impacts of financial capital and the interplay between financial capital and social capital, which is a little bit more complex. We can think about the relationship between material capital, living capital, and financial capital. So it gives us a framework for asking better questions, right?
Yeah.
But it is not meant as a model, and it's living, it's emergent. A lot of people commonly ask, why didn't we include time or temporal capital? A lot of people point out sort of, hey, why isn't health capital in here? There's a common set of patterns that people's minds spring to. We did our best to think with some living systems framework. So creating sort of like that combination of observation and then and relationship. So we commonly, so I would sort of say temporal capital, I would really call as, I would link it to the attention economy. And it's really, it's human time and attention that is oftentimes from a Marxist perspective talked about as labor, which I don't think is a form of capital. I think it is what, it is like the connective fabric that connects the different forms of capital together. Right. And we talk a little bit about that in our writings, probably not as much as we should, but sort of time and attention is our way of talking about labor. And it is how we go about giving our time and attention dictates the relationships between these different forms of capital.
Plus, like, it gives you potentially a way to think about time outside of discounting, right? Which is kind of like the way that a lot of that the neoclassical models kind of use to sort of use time as a future, to how we can kind of discount against the future for X resource, build a derivatives market, et cetera.
Totally. One, and another disclaimer here is, I mean, as I mentioned before, although I have, so I took economics in college and I hated it and thought everyone who was studying it or doing it was fucking stupid and crazy, just to be honest. Like, I thought it was like pathological to me when I took.
Yeah. I just want to point out here just quickly, Gregory, I started in neuroscience. I dropped out of University of Chicago. I finished in economics, but it was only because it was easier than the neuroscience. So I don't want to be put in that. I don't want to be put in that group.
Well, and this is my naive, reactive self. Like when I was in college and I was just, but so I like rejected it. But at the same time, I was, as you can tell, I was like fascinated with it. So my first step in a weird way was to like throw it all away and go create this complex emergent situation to observe and kind of regenerate a folk theory of economics, right? And so it was not based on reading. It was sort of like, I was like, I pushed all that stuff away, all those other thinkers and all you, I'm just going to assume that it's bad. And that's naive. And I'm not suggesting that that's like the optimal way to approach things. I'm just owning that that is the way that I approached it. And then through sort of, again, really, it's a folk framework. I would consider the eight forms of capital and regenerative enterprise to be sort of a folk economics, right? We were creating it from the grassroots up through experiment and through sort of a systematic observation and participatory design to create something that seemed to match what that our need and the moment. And since going through that experience and kind of having that grounding, it has been, I am much more fascinated and excited. And I feel like I have the ability in a non-reactive way to sort of engage with and appreciate and understand the wisdom that's embedded in the academic discipline of economics, but sort of taken with a grain of salt. I have sort of a foundation of my own, an empirical foundation of my own to say, ah, that maybe is, I don't know, let's be cautious there, or, oh, that's very interesting, right? That's very interesting how that's being approached. So now I would say I'm much more fascinated and interested in the formal discipline and the sort of like getting into the mechanism design and the game theory, like the different branches of economics that then start to bring us towards or are actually emergent out of the crypto economy. How are we as a community governing and programming sort of our social algorithms, our economic algorithms? How do we update them? What are they? How do we reveal the ones that exist? How do we update them? How do we explore completely new ones? I'm fascinated by, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you to backtrack a little bit, because you are, as you see, you can see it and everything you've done. It's kind of like you butted up against it and you're like, I don't like having value only dictated in this one way and a number of times in your background. And you, it's weird because that's, like you said, very polarizing for some people, and they crash or they be at that inflection point, they go one way or the other. And usually you see these communities emerge that are, you know, I guess one way is like the hippie community, or you have sharing economy, gift economies that try to get bootstrapped and never work because they can't get enough throughput for exchange and all that. And so eventually you either look at it and you go, well, the system works for the one thing it's doing. Can it work for other things? And you can really see that in the way you think about it. And I wanted to ask you, back when you wrote the regenerative enterprise, had you read the Bitcoin white paper? Were you aware of crypto at that time?
I was aware of crypto at that time. Yeah, I became aware of crypto weirdly, like in 2009, actually during the bioregional Congress. So we were having conversations around the campfire as bioregionalists about the Bitcoin white paper. I was fascinated by it. I found it naive and incomplete, and I've never been bought into the... I was less bought in. I'm more bought into the Bitcoin thesis now than I was then, by a long shot. But by a long shot. To me, at that point, it was cool and interesting to think about the decoupling, and I resonated with the decoupling of the creation of money from the sort of central banking system. At that time, I had a sort of a naive straw man understanding that was born out of what's the Venus Project's old documentary with the, anyway, there's like old, I've seen other people in the space were influenced by it. I had a similar naive understanding about banking and finance that it seems that Satoshi did, right? As far as I can tell, Satoshi and the Bitcoiners don't have a solid understanding of how money really works. I could get into like how it does work and how it doesn't work.
I won't dispute that. I pretty much agree with you.
And just to share with listeners, like the Bitcoin white paper and me at that time both assume and both give way too much power to central banks. Like central banks do have some levers to influence markets by adjusting interest rates, by printing some amount of money, but they do not control the money supply, right? The money comes into being, for the vast majority of money, I don't even know what it is, but it's a vast majority of money, comes into being through private lending, private debt in the fractional reserve system. And so I did understand that, but it's sort of talked about in a very centralized way oftentimes, right? And so I understood fractional reserve, but it gets conflated. And anyway, we actually have a much more weirdly decentralized money system than I think most Bitcoiners would give the system credit for.
That's funny. Well, now I think we have a good accounting of all of your hats and your history, because I think they tie together super interestingly in the next direction we're going to go. So basically, you were almost kind of, you backed into almost being an economics, almost I'd say savant, because of the experiences you had where you're like, well, it seems like the folks here who I'm close with and educating with are discounting the effect of being able to potentially create your own form, create and account for and make legible your own forms of value, community owned and what have you, that could be a thing. And of course, you had all the principles from permanent agriculture, permaculture for short, that kind of tied into your background. You ran a co-op, you were interested in, had participated in other forms of governance. And so then you arrive at, maybe we're now a little bit nearing the present and what you're doing with Regen. And if I look out, one of the things in your past that's now reemerged and has become a meme, it's this regenerative finance meme, right? So I refer to it as a meme in Web3. I know it has an actual tradition of at least 20, 25 years outside of Web3. Can you tell us a bit, you know, for you, what is regenerative finance?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of different lineages of thought that that should be discussed when we discuss regenerative finance or ReFi. I think there's sort of the regenerative enterprise, sort of like what I just described, the part of that that I've been a part of, this sort of like permaculture emergent. I think transition towns was happening at the same time. I think there was like a very rich around that same time as Bitcoin was coming out, rich sort of like, in a way, independent movement, permaculture inspired by and large. It's like how permaculture approached as a movement, money, finance, ownership, and what is called in the permaculture designer's manual, invisible structures. So there's that lineage. Then there's the Carol Sanford Regenesis living systems approach, which is adjacent to and related to, but is its own thing. And she wrote a book called Regenerative Business. And there's a couple of other ones, The Regenerative Life, No More Feedback, a bunch of really amazing books in which she's exploring kind of based on like her definition of regeneration, which has really deeply influenced me, really has to do with sort of evolutionary capacity and capability to regenerate itself in a dynamic, ongoing way, right? And so these are two different schools of thought. And then you have John Fullerton, and he wrote a white paper called Regenerative Capitalism back around the same time that we were writing Regenerative Enterprise. So, and he similarly sort of like set up a set of principles around that I think, that are adjacent to, then you're sort of going on the spectrum, that are adjacent to sort of circular economy approaches to thinking about things. You have sort of donut economics, think Kate Raworth's work. And all of that, preceding all of that, I would really say is E.F. Schumacher's work, Small is Beautiful, and sort of adjacent thinkers. And there are some, And then sort of like the ecology side of things, I think has always been very important. So you have like Lynn Margulis and, James Lovelock, and sort of like systems theory. Gaia. Some of the names and thinkers that I think oftentimes are inspiring people to be thinking about this, like at a deep, more maybe, or esoteric. I think David Bohm is, and Gregory Bateson, and they're sort of like Cybernetics, people who are like deeper, thinking deeper about epistemology. I think then later, another strand, which I think is very important and influences a lot of people in the current ReFi movement, which I've sort of forgotten and interweaves with the ones that I just laid out, is Charles Eisenstein's work, such as The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. I think that was sort of his first one. And then Sacred Economics was the one that's sort of most grounded in which he's exploring gift economics. So that's kind of the landscape of pre-crypto regenerative finance, regenerative economics, I see it from my little corner. And I'm probably missing people who are doing great work, for which I apologize. But that's the landscape that I have some relationship to.
And then, that's a great solid basis for a lot of this stuff. And honestly, I captured all of it in the show notes. So don't worry if you're listening, you're like, oh no, what were all those books? They're all going to be in the show notes. Don't worry about it. But can you tell us in a bit, you're about 3 or 4 years into Regen Network. What do you kind of see as where is the launch pad, I suppose, for what ReFi is in crypto and Web3 and what it came from? Is there a connection or is it its own thing?
Well, I think there's two potentially complementary, two potentially competitive visions for ReFi. So you have some people who I think have glommed on to ReFi, who I think are by and large completely ignorant, whether willfully ignorant or
just
ignorantly ignorant of sort of there is a movement, there's an exploration, there's a body of work, there are even sort of like even rigorous academic approaches, and a growing sort of like community of inquiry around how we can shift our, you know, sort of like the meta question being, well, no, I'm not going to go into the meta question. I think there's sort of like in the crypto space, I think there's sort of a naive and ignorant adoption of the regen and ReFi meme that doesn't understand the underpinnings of a movement beyond crypto. So they just sort of like picked it up and they vibed with it. And they're like, whoa, this vibes with me. Now let's like put it on hyper, let's like insert Ponzi, you know, Ponzi games and just like pump it. Let's just pump it up. Meme coin the hell out of this.
Yes.
And then there's sort of like the middle ground of people who are intellectually curious enough and that creates, that does some good things. It creates spaciousness and interest and opportunity for people to engage and sort of like grow. And then the intellectually curious among them are sort of like looking under the rug or whatever and going like, wow, there's a trap door down there. And it goes way, way, way down. The rabbit hole goes pretty deep actually around what is possible. And then I think there is actually a fair community of people sort of similar to Regen Network and our corner of things that actually came from the other direction, that came from this sort of like emergent wave that is and found crypto and thought to ourselves, oh, interesting. Wow. So this, you know, and so maybe it's worth sort of unpacking that a little bit. I also want to talk a little bit about sort of like the real origin and idea of Regen Network. I think that's probably,
absolutely,
those are two sort of independent things to unpack.
Oh, pick whichever one you'd like to start with, because I think that now that we have a solid basis for what ReFi is, even outside of crypto, we can begin to say, like, how did Regen Network form? You know, where, what was the formative story around it? Because it sounds like you and the folks you're working with who co-founded it and the team you're with now kind of are grounded in those principles. So take it out.
I actually want to take a crack at defining ReFi before I do that, because I realized I sort of like gave a general sort of wandering commentary, but I didn't actually like root it in what the hell is this from my perspective.
Yes.
So if we say that regeneration is regrowing and increasing the evolutionary capacity and capability of a whole system, and that we use that as the definition, and that has a set of embedded principles and ideas and understanding, kind of complexity science-ish, living systems adjacent, then regenerative finance would be a financial system and financial instruments and tools that increase the evolutionary capacity and capability of, in this case, I would say, of humans at and Earth, or Earth and humans. And I would really probably, you know, nest humans within the biosphere. So, you know, so then there's sort of understanding of humans as the potential evolution of humans towards being a keystone species instead of a parasite. You know, we get into ecological dynamics and understanding, we get to sort of will, choice, cultural evolution, and all those things. But regenerative finance is a vehicle for us to use finance to grow the evolutionary capacity and capability, the systemic health, as it were, of life. Right, up ecosystems. And I think that's a little different from how most people would define ReFi, because I think most people would define ReFi as, in simplistic terms, sort of increasing, sort of like increasing, like fighting climate change with finance, or you know, there's sort of like these linear, sort of like these linear explanations. What is regenerative finance? Oh, regenerative finance is when you do good with your money.
What is good?
And what's good? And so just like setting things up, what is good? This is like Aldo Leopold's land ethic, right? Just bring it back to Aldo Leopold. What is good is that which tends to increase the health and evolutionary capability of our biosphere. That is what is good, right? And so regeneration, so that's the whole. That's the whole system we're thinking of. And then there's nested wholes within that. There's sort of human society, different industries, different bioregions, ecosystems. So regenerative finance is approaching finance, financial instruments, financial tools, and sort of financial systems from a lens of how are we increasing ecological health, biosphere health, and reinforcing the cultural norms, approaches, and value systems that lead to those ends. So then we get into this whole discussion of like back to the eight forms of capital. What is valuable? How do we account for it? How do we create new accounting systems and instruments? Okay, so now we're back to Regen Network. So Regen Network is pretty radical in all of this, in that we're identifying that, okay, value is socially constructed. There's cultural, social, psychological processes by which we generate consensus about what money is and what is worth money. Okay, so what we're saying is, there's sort of like, sure, there's a meme side to that. Sort of there's like propaganda and PR and memes and viral videos and all that stuff. 100%. We do a lot less of that at Regen Network than maybe we ought to. But sort of setting that aside, what is the other component whereby we socially construct value and we evolve new cultural understandings and instrument those understandings into financial systems that represent holistic regenerative value, life value? Well, you know, that science is a part of that, right? Where groups of people come together to create a new understanding of, you know, ecological health, soil health, biodiversity, etc. That's a big part of it. A big part of it is sort of the primary process of unitization, quantification. How do we, you know, in our symbolic representation, at least in the West, in quotes, you know, we use units and quantities in order to create social agreements about value. That's how our culture approaches this. I'm not saying that's the only way or the best way. That's just the way we use it. So, you know, Regen Network at its root is creating a community-owned means of producing and quantifying ecological value.
And how does it do that? Because basically, I think you've mentioned a number of interesting things here. You talked about legibility, you talked about other forms of value and basically capturing them as capital and making them interchangeable, right? So how do some of these principles from your background filter down into Regen Network and its ability to give communities their own way of sort of legibilizing and legitimating value that they define themselves?
Great question. Well, I mean, I think first, sort of starting from first principles, the aim at Regen Network is to build open tools that allow communities to sort of assess and create their own units that represent ecological value. So there isn't a presumption of sort of like a single unified, fungible, sort of like regenerative unit. Instead, we're coming at it from sort of a pluralistic approach where we're saying there's going to be context-specific, place-specific, people-specific, ecosystem-specific units. And our biggest job is to create the toolkit for people to monitor, measure, and quantify ecological units, ecological health in a way that they find, you know, is the right match of culturally and ecologically appropriate and sort of like meeting the market. And there's a sort of like, there's a, then there's a next stage around fungibility. How do those interact with one another. You know, we can get into that, but that's sort of a first principle of how we're approaching it, which I think is pretty different from how a lot of people are approaching this. And, you know, at the same time, you know, and this is sort of me talking from the present moment, not me talking from sort of the ideal or like the vision, right? But in the present moment, we also need to be relevant in serving the needs of an awakening economy that is hungry for existing attempts and existing units, even as flawed as like a carbon credit might be. And we could get into like what carbon credits are good for, what they're not good for, where they are in the evolution or arc of what we're trying to build a foundation for. We need to make it possible because there's an existing community that has social consensus that that's valuable for a variety of reasons. So we need to have tools that allow that there to be evolution of capability and capacity with existing social agreements and economic agreements like carbon credits. So I think from the outside observer, people are like, oh, Region Network is another carbon market or another carbon, sort of like another carbon registry or another carbon project developer or something like that. And it's sort of like, well, yes, we allow people to move up that full stack of value, of consensus about what's valuable and bringing that to the market in the vertical of carbon markets, right? And I think we're doing pretty well at that. And that's kind of, you know, in quotes, our go-to-market strategy, right? But underpinning that is a bigger theory of change. And that bigger theory of change is we need open source, community-owned and governed tools to be able to create symbolic representations of ecological health for people to use to embed into their financial, economic, and cultural relationships with one another.
Got it. And I think like this now also crosses into institutional relationships a bit, because basically one of the main themes of what we talk about on the pod, right, is the, this is really also Martin's background and how we kind of hooked up, is that we were both really interested in what new possibilities are enabled by alternative ownership structures, and especially ones that extend ownership more broadly and governance rights more broadly to more stakeholders. And so I think, you know, looking at how you think of communities and what you're building on Region, it's really extends things in two ways, which I'm interested to dig into. One is the governance side. You're going to have more stakeholders and you're going to have ways to incorporate them in ways that aren't currently sort of addressed. You know, a lot of these things are currently addressed by public and private ownership, right? So there's the notion of public land or public resources. They're managed by existing institutions that are related to governments. There's, you know, this is just the situation as it is. It's a bureaucracy of some kind manages a resource on behalf of a state-owned entity or a state entity. And then there are private entities that are given rights to those resources and through various other processes. And that's it. The shareholders who govern those resources or have to say over how they're used as inputs for other parts of the economy or into other private companies. That's it. So really what you're building here, what I'd like to come back to and dig into a bit more, so you kind of enunciated it, is you will give, you know, maybe we dig into a specific example around a community that is using a region to do this, but I'd love to hear more like if we can make a community less of an abstraction and go like, hey, here's a community that's using it and how they're doing it, right? Does that make sense? Right, what do you think of that?
Yeah, sure. So folks can go and, you know, so the two places to maybe like dig in to sort of documentation or make what I'm about to be talking about a little bit more concrete and look at different examples, we could be looking at the Built on Region page, in which there's sort of tabs that show people who are working together to create new eco credits, which is what these units of account are defined as in the Region Network sort of lexicon, right? So these are eco credits. And then there's the community staking DAO process, which is managed by the foundation. Those are sort of complementary, sometimes deeply connected, sometimes independent processes. So the community staking, and I'll sort of go patterns to details, so we'll get to some of the concrete examples. So the community staking endowment process is, you know, part of our thesis has been, let's, you know, okay, number one, we're building a public application and domain specific blockchain as the new institutional framework to bring stakeholders together to own this, to own the state machine, the blockchain that is serving for sort of sense making, monitoring, reporting, and verification, and unitization of these assets. So there's a whole origination cycle that are this concrete features that currently exist to allow that to take place, right? And then there's a lot more that the community is thinking about how to build this. People could look at docs.region.network for sort of the technical specifications there. The community staking endowment is 30% of the network stake, which has been set aside to endow, you know, E-N-D-A-O, to endow specific non-transactional, non-market, like participants who would not be able to participate in an open market to procure governance tokens.
Got it.
And so along with the foundation, which is a member, is a 501c3 registered in the United States, in which there is a consortium, a membership consortium, which governs the board. So there's sort of a transparent community governed institution, which also governs 5% of the stake. There is 35% of the stake, which is set aside for known organizations in good standing with missions aligned with the network, in which you can only procure those tokens. And when they get endowed, they're non-transferable. So there's this interesting experiment on Region Network, which is sort of a hybrid in which we have a Byzantine veto of previously excluded stakeholders, environmental and indigenous rights activists, right?
This is awesome.
Rights of nature organizations, science groups, civic organizations. And so they have a Byzantine, they are being granted through this process. And there's a lot of work to do on digital literacy and blockchain governance and all of these other pieces. But there's an institution which has a public responsibility encoded in its bylaws and is being managed by an open consortium to do that, that has to endow to those communities and figure out the problems with doing so, right? And do education, do processes around that. And they're in their second cohort right now of endowments. There's some really amazing groups going through the processes. There's bioregional initiatives like the Earth Regenerators, Barichara down in Colombia. There are indigenous groups in the Amazon of Ecuador. There are women's co-ops in Kenya and India who are going through these processes. There are, you know, amazing sort of like leaders in the crypto space like Commons Stack and the token engineering commons that are part and participating. So it's a plurality. It's a very interesting process, but they literally are participating not as like a steering committee of a bureaucratic entity or something like that. They get to participate in the fundamental governance of the state machine itself, which includes the sort of like nested system of accountability, governance of token standards, governance of economic, you know, algorithms, the minting of Region standards, and all the things that the executable on-chain logic that Region Ledger allows. They get to govern all of that. And just like from the fundamental base layer, they're participating as stakeholders.
I think there are two really interesting things you got into there, which really cross into ownership, because this is basically a new, in some ways, it's a new almost paradigm of ownership, or at least a new form of enabling this type of ownership, because essentially you're to build a sort of public goods ownership model here, because you're basically saying, hey, here's a number of things that either because the granting authorities do not recognize these forms of ownership or need to have, you know, one entity own a particular thing, you've actually found a way to get a number of folks to basically say, how do we co-own an entity and account for what it actually produces? And the second really interesting thing, which is really gaining steam in this space, is you didn't use these words, but I'm going to kind of put it this way, just because, you know, now we get to get at least a little bit spicy about it, is, you know, this tokenizing natural assets. This is not something that only, you know, folks like yourself are on, like a lot of venture capitalists are taking note of this. They're looking at the space and saying, hey, tokenizing natural assets are going to be massive, massive, massive markets, right? And when you think about the current ownership structures, this is not something that a, you know, a, even if, like if you think of a, if you run a factory of some kind, maybe it's just, it has a petrochemical input and it's producing plastic bubbles, whatever. Let's run into something simple, right? Your input's there. If you consider things like ecosystem services, you're going to need water, you're going to need, you know, fuel for transporting. There's going to be a lot of other ecosystem, you know, services that are inputs that basically you do not have to ever make legible. And so Regen Network is really doing two things that are super interesting. One is it's extending ownership and governance rights to a lot of folks who don't traditionally have it or can't find ways to make the ownership primitives work for them in their own structures. And the second, you're really saying at that point, you can tokenize whatever form of value is important to you, and then you can account for it within the state machine that is Regen Network. Does that sound right?
That sounds exactly right. And, you know, and I just want to say for a second, you know, like at the high level, then there is going to be a giant, the neoliberal economy is giving, you know, which we're all embedded in. And I don't say that like pejoratively. I use it to sort of like anchor a set of philosophies and institutional approaches of the still dominant, but somewhat wobbly kind of economic framework we're all living in right now, is giving birth to a new economic approach, which includes some form of, you know, sort of like natural capitalism, a la Paul Hawken, who I didn't mention in my whole regenerative economics stuff, or regenerative capitalism, a la John Fullerton, and natural capital assets, like NASDAQ has a natural capital corporation project, and the World Economic Forum says, oh, this is going to be a $2 trillion per year industry, and the World Bank has all sorts of working groups. So that's just to say that the existing institutions, are embracing the understanding of a new asset class, which is reflected by ecological health. Okay, that's cool. So is the crypto world. That's cool. Okay, but fundamentally, you know, this isn't just hand-wavy, airy-fairy, hippy-dippy bullshit to say that the process of making something legible needs to include stakeholders that both the crypto economy and more so, or to the same extent, maybe, the existing neoliberal economy has left out. We cannot account for the public goods of ecological health without including the public. And the public isn't an abstract entity. It's specific place-based communities who are the land stewards. It's specific communities who support sense-making, the science around that. And, you know, so we need to embed the market infrastructure into the ownership of those stakeholders. Otherwise, there's not accountability and there won't be legitimacy and there won't be buy-in. So what will happen is we will have a giant subprime carbon collapse. We'll have a giant subprime natural capital collapse if financialization happens within the sort of abstracted world of just the finance industry, right? So they like, so if the money then, because it isn't an exercise in money, like all the incentives are for the money to make more money for itself without actually deeply considering the other forms of capital. The other forms of capital, the other seven forms of capital besides financial capital, need nurturing by and large. They need grounded relationships. The wealth emerges out of a holistic context. It doesn't emerge, like it doesn't accumulate to itself in the same way. They have different characteristics. And that's, you know, obvious. That's obvious and true. So if you're taking a step back and asking, how are we going to create the foundations for a new regenerative economy, but you're not baking in a radical inclusion in the ownership of the means of production of the new units of account, you're fucked. We're fucked. The whole thing is going to collapse and it's going to be really ugly, because when everything gets financialized, it will be the worst nightmare of many different groups of people that see the problems with that. And it will, you know, who's going to get rugged when the bubble pops is going to be the most vulnerable people who are actually in this sort of like, you know, snake eating its own tail Ouroboros world that we live in, the most vulnerable people are the most important. They're the keystones of ecological regeneration. They're the people who hold the stewardship of the most vulnerable ecosystems. They're the people who...
Biodiversity, yep, et cetera.
Exactly. So I could just get on a whole rant train around that, but it's just from a purely utilitarian, and I guess right now I'm just talking to, if there are any listeners out there who are self-identifying VCs and capital allocators, they need to understand that, you know, any play that they're going to be backing needs to be competing with Regen Network on better reflecting the ownership of previously marginalized peoples. Because if you're not competing with us or investing in that, it's an open community initiative. You're welcome to just join it instead of compete with it. That's cool too. But if you're investing in something that's competing and you're not competing on the axis of radical inclusion, you will fail. And probably you'll catalyze the entire endeavor to fail too. And then things will get ugly.
I think that's a good spot to begin to ask. You know, we covered a lot of ground on what refi is, what natural capital is, what good possibilities are. When you look at, you know, the movement today, you dug into a little bit of what you see as problematic, but where does it go wrong from here, right? There's poor ownership structures, there's, you know, not including folks, but where do you think refi goes wrong? How does it crash? What do we have to avoid?
Boy, I mean, I think the biggest risk is that at this moment, and it's already happening, so the chances of refi succeeding are diminishing by the day, I think, from my sort of like jaded, curmudgeonly, I've been doing this for years, you fucking kids, get off my lawn perspective.
I am also a curmudgeon, so I'm sure I'm going to share this. Go on.
So there's a massive market fragmentation taking place, which, you know, from a naive perspective, is like, oh, great, there's going to be all this competition. Okay, but look, the competitive dynamics that are emerging are not about substance. They're about hype. And so therefore, the people who spend the most money on hype cycles will win. And the public, we need to grow our evolutionary capacity and capability as a community, as a culture, as individuals, as businesses, as a society to value ecological regeneration, right? Not to trust someone else to do it for us. Because if we're trusting someone else to do it us, we get into this weird social media hype engine, fragmented, polarized team, you know, dynamic marketplace in which the competitive dynamics are such that, like, in which we're not competing over who is regenerating the fastest and who has the deepest soil or who has the best science or who has the most community inclusion in the process. We're just competing over who can own the latest hype cycle.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous. And people just need to own that that's on us as industry leaders. That's on us as entrepreneurs. That's on us as investors in the space, that we have a choice. We have a choice, and we can sort of do it a way in which it's the classic prisoner's dilemma, sort of like game theoretical, you know, and it's not the prisoner's dilemma. There's probably another game that's more precise, but it's prisoner's dilemma-ish. You might have the right game that I'm not remembering. But, you know, we're in a game right now where if we cooperate, right, as around something like Regen Network, right? And people think, oh, Regen Network's just another competing thing. Regen Network isn't just another competing thing. We're trying to create a neutral, sovereign, stakeholder-owned system that's open source and isn't being built on another rent-seeking layer one platform or attached to an existing institution, right? We're trying to build something that people can opt into and co-own so that in the Web3 space, you could imagine all the ecosystems that want to engage with the use of high quality ecological assets can co-own and cooperate region as a neutral place alongside the land stewards and the scientists and the, you know, the rights of nature, you know, reserves and orgs and activists. We can co-own it together and it can feed the refi economy, right? And so that actually gets us out of the prisoner's dilemma. There's if we choose to cooperate, we can have an omni-win scenario in which we're building the norms for legitimacy and we're building the competitive dynamics across the space by opting into a decentralized, community-owned, pre-competitive, neutral application specific state machine that can feed all of the other ones that have their different theses. They want to compete on different things. They want to have, they want to secure their stable coin. They want to collateralize this. They want to offset their NFTs. They want to do all the cool things, but it all relies on us having that solid new institutional infrastructure that doesn't currently exist except for region network. But the risk is everybody tries to create it in a fragmented, weird way. And again, the outcome of that I painted, right? The outcome of that is it's the wrong, then we're competing on the wrong things, right? Yeah. So if a competitor to region was to actually emerge, that would be fantastic for the space, right? If there was another neutral origination system that was like, we're going to do better at stakeholder engagement. We're going to do better at data management. We're going to do better at, you know, okay, cool. That I would not be anxious about that. I would be stoked. I would be stoked. But instead, we have, you know, different layer ones trying to compete to pull it onto their state machine because that's their direct incentives. Their direct incentives is to hype their specific token and to make, you know, their numbers go up and do all these different things. So they're competing with each other to try to own it instead of, or that's what the incentives are. You know, that's the game that is moving, right? And the further we get into that game, the harder it gets for people to opt in to the game theoretical sort of like omni-win scenario, right? So, yeah.
No, I think that was a good spot because I think you painted a good vision of, and a real vision of what, where we are and where we can go wrong. And I think like it really encapsulates everything we covered, which is community governments, community ownership, the way we're not measuring ecological health really like outside in little niches elsewhere around the world. Scientists are doing it, but we need a way to coordinate around this. I think you really nailed that. That makes a ton of sense. And I think this is actually a good spot to bring it on home. So can you tell us a bit, you know, if you listen to this and you're like, how do I compete with Region Network? Where can I join their community? Find out how they work, get and see what I can do better or even become part of the community. Where can they find you and where can they find Region?
Yeah, so you can go to region.network and, you know, on the bottom of the page, there's the, you know, if you're technical, there's the GitHub. Everything's open source always. We're quite strict about that. There's Discord, which is currently the public forum for asking questions and engaging as community members. Twitter, all the things. You can go connect with all the things. You can find me on Twitter at Gregory_Landaway. And yeah, there's also, of course, there's a governance forum in which a lot of these conversations, the details of these conversations are unfolding, which is cool. And you can tune in to Regenerati NewsHour. We have a Twitter Spaces every week in which we get into like geeky, fun, community-driven conversations about kind of the edges of what's happening. And we talk about AI and machine learning, or we talk about, you know, the community discussions around our token economics and how we might upgrade those. We talk about different eco credit initiatives. All sorts of fun things are happening in those Twitter spaces. So those are sort of, that's the brief overview of how to engage if folks are interest is peaked. And, you know, definitely I would say this is a, you know, we are doing our best to build in public and build with and for the community. So yeah, just super excited if people are enlivened by the idea to just, you know, roll your sleeves up, come dig in.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gregory, for joining us. And we really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It was fun. Hopefully my ranting was useful.
No, we're going to have to get you back on again, but you know, to go into this in more detail, it's always great to hear you talk because you know so much about the space.
Right on. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Great. I love the work you guys are doing on the podcast. Super honored to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. Macro, baby.